And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, veterans of all ages. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Rocky, and the problems within the VA just continue to escalate. I mean, it's beyond comprehension. One thing we want to remember today with this show and everything, we have lost one of the great, great veterans advocates. Steve died, and it's been out there for a couple days now. He died on Thursday. And Steve's contributions overall to everything that have happened are just, I mean, it can't even be staggering. Steve Robinson, he's up in heaven, and hopefully we got an angel for us. But we're going back to the fundamentals tonight, and we have one of the great physicians in our nation on here tonight, Gary Ridenour. Dr. Ridenour, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. Well, you know, what we're going to come back from antiquity, one of the big problems that's affected all military personnel is drug and alcohol abuse, specifically alcohol abuse. And Gary, let's talk about it tonight. I mean, you're an expert in this stuff, and you can help us try to understand why and what's happening and what we need to do.
Well, it goes back. I have bottles in my office from the Civil War that were supposed to be stomach bitters, and the Union doctors and the Confederate doctors bought these stomach bitters by the car train load, because they would sell them to the soldiers because they had a lot of alcohol in them. So they would they had their own business as being bootleggers in the Civil War. And, of course, it goes back even farther. But World War II was our real benchmark for the alcohol abuse, because of the fact that we scooped up about 13 million men and women. And the lifestyle then was smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol. And war ended, and we ended up with a large number of the veterans that were, permanently were alcoholics. And we didn't take care of them.
One thing that bothers me, and I remember when I enlisted in the Air Force in 1967, cigarettes were part of your everyday issue. I mean, they were in your food and everything else. I mean, take a smoke break. I mean, they were issued to you. And alcohol, I mean, you go to the club, and it's kind of like, well, you get a mixed drink for a nickel or a dime. And why did all this stuff happen? How did it get going to be so bad?
Well, like I said, at the beginning, in the military, a lot of high stress. You also have a lot of people that are in the military that are not well educated. They've come from family backgrounds of alcoholism also. So with a lot of time on their hands, they start drinking. And so World War II, that was the big social thing to do, was to drink. And like you said, they just pumped cigarettes all over the place. So it was just that was an accepted protocol, was to drink alcohol. And whenever you could, you drank alcohol. And it's permeated through until Vietnam War, and then we started getting into drugs, and started smoking pot, and then, a lot of veterans were told if they smoked heroin that they wouldn't get addicted. And one of my friends, a few years after the war, committed suicide because of the fact that he could not get off the heroin, because he certainly was addicted from smoking the heroin. And the number of men and women that came back from Vietnam that were officially counted as being, addicted to either alcohol or drugs, the numbers are really scarce and hard to find. They really didn't want to bring that factor up, plus the other factor about how many people went AOWL in the Vietnam War. There was quite a few people just disappeared from the war. They walked away.
That's staggering. I mean, back in the Civil War and in Indian Wars, wasn't laudanum, that's a narcotic, wasn't that used all over the place for pain?
That's you could actually go into stores and buy laudanum, and it become a significant problem until Oh, I believe it was 1925, 1927, somewhere in there, where they made laudanum outlawed for over-the-counter sales, and then down the road, then the development of the Drug Enforcement Agency began. But that was really just, you know, was an opium, and you could, it was easy to buy anywhere. And you mixed it with your alcohol, and a lot of people did that. And, of course, smoking of opium was, you know, in the Orient was very, very common. And 1949, the communist Chinese fixed the opium problem in China. They executed 27 million opium users. And that, wow, was the end, that was the end of the opium dens.
That's staggering. I mean, just imagine all this stuff that happened. Now, back in the Revolutionary War, I mean, obviously what we know today of history, George Washington had an incredible distillery himself as a commanding general. So he's having an issue. Didn't, back all the way to antiquity, wasn't there a daily issue? I mean, you had daily issues of rum. Was there daily issues of whiskey and all this other stuff?
Yeah, there was the, especially in Europe, because of water being bad, for example, France, wine was consumed frequently because of bad water. In 1735, I know for sure, when my first of my family came over on the boat, you had a daily issue of beer that you drank because they were not set up to be able to have water that was, you know, in containers that would stay, you know, clean. So you got a beer ration on the boat on the way over. So, you know, alcohol was very prevalent. Plus, a lot of water was, you know, contaminated, and it was not, you know, not able to be used for human use. So in came the alcohol.
Well, I mean, how far back does it go where the troops, I mean, even in the Vietnam and the current wars and everything, I mean, one of the things I ran into as a combat medic in part of my life was what we call tanker's punch. And this is kind of like they mixed anything and everything together to get with a little bit of alcohol. And it, I mean, just literally, I mean, incredible toxic compounds would go in there to try and get a kick or alleviate some of the problems they had. I mean, geez, I mean, how far back does that go, the tanker's punch?
That probably goes back, I'd say, probably maybe as far as the Revolutionary War. As far as drinking in the military, I mean, you go back, the Egyptians had beer and, you know, had their own alcohol. And then you go farther back, and, of course, people, you know, had different seeds and things that they smoked and ate to, you know, give them a high or to give them hallucinations so that they could communicate with the spirits and so on. So when you look at people, you know, trying to get high, it's pretty easy to jump back 30, 40,000 years that, you know, we've been doing this.
And as all this stuff with the military, and I mean, this is another area, you study so much of this and been renowned in your field. I mean, as the problems with war and battles and everything, and everybody start hitting all these ethical, moral crises, they start getting all these medical problems, which we're seeing today, and they can't get alleviated because they can't get proper medical care. Isn't it very easy for everybody to drop back and select, well, I'm just going to drink my problems away or take an alcohol or something or whatever, wine or beer, to kind of temporarily alleviate the problem?
Yeah, when I talk with an alcoholic or drug addict, sometimes, lots of times, I run into, I don't really use that much, you know, and I really don't have a problem here. And I stop and I go, we have a problem. There's three of us here in the room. There's you and me and your drug problem. And I haven't talked to you yet. I've been talking to your drug problem, you know. So it's going to take a little while, you know, in the recovery program before you're going to be able to get your drug problem aside and start talking about what's really going on with you. Because the same thing with the alcoholics. They go, well, I drink just a little bit. And sometimes the wife will be there, and she'll be shaking her head no. And you go, well, how much do you drink? He goes, oh, I drink two or three mixed drinks a night. And then I confuse them, and I go, so about a quart or two a week? And they'll go, yeah, about that. And then I come back and go, well, that doesn't add up to a drink or two a night. We're lying here about our consumption, and we've got to get down to the basis where this, you've gotten to the point where the drugs or the alcohol have now become a major impediment to your life. They've gotten in the way of your life, where before your life, I extend my arms way out and I said, this was your life before. And then I bring my hands, my palms real close together, and I go, this is your life now, acquiring and using. You don't go to your kids' basketball games. You don't leave the house. You've now lost your job. And so all you do is just buy alcohol and drink, or get your drugs and drink. That the rest of everything in your world is gone. You're down to one little part, and it's destroying your life. And sometimes I just talked to a gentleman the other day, and I said, heroin's getting quite bad out here in the West, in Nevada. And how long you been slamming heroin, which is a street name for shooting it? And he goes, oh, about 12 years. And I stopped and went, wait a minute. You can't still be alive and be slamming heroin for 12 years. How many years have you done in prison? And he goes, four or five. And I went, okay, that's why you're telling me you've been doing it for 12 years, is because you had a five-year gap there where you were in prison and you were away from the heroin. Because they get to the point where they don't care about what they're shooting. Someone will bring in some powder and say, hey, Sam shot this yesterday and really got a buzz off of it. And you go, what is it? They go, I don't know, try it. And I've asked the addicts, I go, aren't you afraid? And they go, I don't care. If it kills me, I don't care. I'm going to shoot it and see what it does. And it's, I've learned a lot. I've got one addict that's been clean for 4 years, and I've learned so much from her. One day I was actually talking to her and had a drug problem, and it's been gone for quite a while. And she said, I can't believe how much of my life I wasted in bathrooms, shooting up. And I never thought of that before.
It seems to be a staggering problem no matter what we do.
It is, and the Mexicans are switching over. Marijuana, price per pound, it's bulky and hard to ship. They're starting to get rid of the marijuana fields and going to poppies and switching over to black tar heroin. And I'd say in the last 3 months of 100 heroin addicts I've seen, not one of them was older than 25. I mean, some of them are starting in their early teens. And they think that every time you shoot, you're going to get this wonderful high and everything. And what happens is that with time, that wonderful high goes away, and you get to the point where every 3 or 4 hours, you've got to shoot again, just to feel normal, to stop the withdrawal symptoms from coming on. And go ahead.
Yeah, what is happening in the body physiologically? I mean, alcohol has so many physiological effects, and I'm not sure everybody truly understands those. Could you go through those a little, please?
Yeah, well, alcohol is more of a depressant on the system. We actually have alcohol receptors. Alcohol goes in and on brain cells, slows things down. It goes into the liver. It is toxic in the liver. They've done studies on gorillas where they fed them alcohol for like 8 days in a row and then did liver biopsies on them and found out that they had liver damage already from the alcohol. It impairs judgment. It slows your heart rate down, slows your respirations. Larger doses, you can stop breathing. You can throw up and actually inhale what you're throwing up and die within just a minute or two from it. What we're learning now is that there are more and more receptors for things, and I've been starting to keep a log now of my addicts, and I go, okay, your drug of choice is heroin, and it hits what we call the opioid receptor in the brain. Now, what was your threshold drug? And I go, what do you mean? I said, well, what did you start off with? And it's not very frequently infrequently they'll say marijuana. Lots of times they'll go, I got into my mother's pain pills, and boy, did I like those. They don't like the guy or the man or the woman who has opioid receptors that when they load them with the drug, makes them feel really good, whereas marijuana hits another receptor, and for the way their genetics is set up, they're not too interested in marijuana. And so it's difficult, but we're starting now to, I know I am in this office, we're starting to take our addicts and we do a buccal smear. We get some cells out of the inside of their mouth. We send them off to a company, and what they do is we check off, heroin or opiates, alcohol, marijuana, maybe Prozac and a couple other antidepressants, and then the genetic study will come back and tell us, for example, they're very, very good at metabolizing heroin. They're not good at metabolizing Prozac, but Prozac inhibits the action of opiates. And so what we're doing now is we're looking actually, or at least I am in my office now, I'm looking at the genetic structure of your metabolism and getting an idea, you know, why you like this drug or why you like that drug. And the interesting thing about it, we're doing this with Millennium Laboratories, but the interesting thing is that these things are called cytochromes, and they're in the mitochondria, the little energy packages in your cell. Well, those mitochondria come from your mother. And I'm starting to look at to see if we're seeing a pattern for one drug or another that you can relate right back to mom, you know. And it's tough because, you know, some addictive personalities we get in, they're polysubstance abusers. I mean, they come in and go, I do coke, I do pot, I shoot heroin when I can get a hold of it, I drink a lot of alcohol, and I mean, it's just amazing about, you know, what their field of abuse is. And I say about 1 out of 10 we get a polysubstance abuser that, you name it, I use it. And it's really tough. And we go back to Afghanistan now, and Afghanistan has the largest opium fields in, I think, probably the world. And if the United States had removed all those poppy fields, in 2 weeks there would be no heroin in Europe. But we did not do that because supposedly the president of Afghanistan's brother is a member of the tribal groups that run the opium business, and we didn't want to interfere with the opium business. So it continued on, and we ended up with a lot of troops addicted to heroin. And, you know, they've come back, and the VA systems for addiction and, you know, a bit being habituated to cigarettes and so on and so forth, is not a very good system. It's, you know, you don't have the top people in the field there. You just, you kind of go, okay, well, stop doing that stuff and we'll see you in 2 weeks. And out the door you go. And, you know, and that's why you've got to go, if you are an addict, you've got a lot of spare time. You got to start going to meetings and you know, go to 12-step meetings. And sometimes that 12-step meetings aren't for you, but it gives you somewhere to go to at least use up your time until, you know, you try to get straight again. The
now, one of the things that's cropped up latest, Dr. Beatrice Golab at the VA in San Diego has found out that the mitochondria are severely damaged from all the toxic exposures.
Yeah, now, the cytochromes do get banged up, and that's what we're doing with these genetic studies right now, is trying to see down the road which are the cytochromes, the proteins that break certain drugs down. Is it the slow metabolizer cytochrome in the mitochondria that's getting beat up, or is it the fast metabolizer? You know, which one is doing this? And you're getting it from mom, and so, you know, the big question is, was mom an alcoholic, or was mom a drug addict, or, you know, what happened? But, you know, you look at alcoholics and drug addicts and those that have been doing it for years and years, and just by looking at them, you can see how much they've aged from, you know, the cellular damage that they've done to their systems, you know, and cardiac problems. And you fire up a powder and draw it up into a syringe and shoot it into your vein. That's going right into your lungs. And there's a lot of powder-like substances that go back into solids and deposit in the lung. So, you know, I've seen guys that acted like they had emphysema, and it was from all the stuff that the heroin was cut with that went into the lung and stayed in the lung.
Well, we got so many incredible respiratory problems all over, going back, you know, with all the toxic compounds, the destruction of the infrastructure, and released all this stuff. It has a horrible effect on all levels of the respiration. So you got the alveoli sacs are damaged, so they can't take adequate oxygen in. The blood system and all this stuff in the mitochondria are damaged, as are the cells, so they can't get adequate perfusion. And then you've got all this stuff happening right on top, so it just seems like it's a never-ending nightmare.
It is. I haven't seen one in a little bit, but somebody who's 25 years old, they're absolutely just bones. They're yellow as a banana because their livers are dead, and I call them a spent bullet. It's, you know, it's all over at 25. It's and the other thing is, by the way, is that Obama wants to cut back our emissions in our country. The problem is that India and China have not agreed to cut back any of their emissions, especially China. China told the U.S. indirectly, you had your industrial revolution and nobody controlled, you know, what you put into the air. So we're having our industrial, you know, revolution, and we're not going to work at trying to cut pollution, you know, and they just, they're poisoning millions of their people from the pollution from their industry.
My mind boggles, I think. So we've got all this stuff. We've got incredible alcohol abuse amongst the troops are frustrated. They're coming out. They got to relax. They're trying to get pain alleviation. So they use alcohol. They make whatever they can, however they can, get it wherever they can. And then you got a nightmare. And then obviously we got prescription drugs, which seem to be abused all over, and just maintaining control, because when the pain levels get out of control, you can't get medical care. It seems to me the easiest way out, what I've seen, is people go back on what they have available and use it. So now we get into a crisis mode there, where instead of, you know, you're only supposed to take one every 8 hours, they're down to taking them, what, as often as they possibly can until they run out?
I've seen doctors do Vicodin by the handful. beforehand to go to work, a handful of them. The city of Chicago is suing about four drug companies right now for misrepresenting the narcotics that they produce. And they're trying to get them to cut back on the narcotics that are being used in Chicago. The interesting problem is that the United States is 8% of the world's population. We consume 94% of the opiates made in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. You break your leg in Germany, and they give you tell you to go get some Motrin, and you go, oh, can I get some Vicodin or OxyContins? And they look at you like, you know, you're from outer space. You know, it's a cultural thing here. I mean, we live on opiate pain medications.
Now, obviously, you know, we're looking at real pain problems. I mean, I've got them myself and everybody I know, my whole team does, and they're dead. And we don't know what happened to Steve Robinson other than he was 51 years old, got zapped during Desert Storm. But could proper medical care, and all this has to come together, unless I'm missing something. You got the physiology, anatomy and physiology involved. You got availability, all this stuff. But then if you're going to hope to win on this or control it, don't you have the mind and the spirit totally intertwined?
You do. And you have to start off real early in elementary school and that, and start educating the children that these things are bad, and bring in the fact that if you're in a house where mom is being beat up by dad, there's a good chance that there's a drug or alcohol involved in it, and that you've got to be able to try to educate them at the same time. Our problem is that we've had all these mass shootings recently, and because the school systems have cut back on funding, so the person who is a problem student doesn't go and see the psychologist anymore because the psychologist isn't there anymore. So that person slides through the system, and a few years after, you know, high school or whatever, they're shooting up people in a movie house or somewhere, and because they've slid through the system because it's fallen apart.
Well, we're seeing the same thing with the veterans. I mean, we've got incredible levels of child and spouse abuse in the veterans. We've got incredible high levels of crime from veterans. I mean, way beyond anything that should be there. But again, it's this total frustration. I mean, it seems today, again, discussing with everybody and going there, post-traumatic stress, okay, historicals back to antiquity. But rather than alleviating the real cause of the problem, they seem to want to prescribe all these psychotropic meds and everything else. So now when you combine psychotropic meds with pain meds, God almighty, what's happening to the body?
Well, what you have to do is, and this is where psychiatrists kind of missed the boat a little bit, is that my depressed patients, I go, big mood swings, get mad easy, don't feel like going anywhere, doing anything, decreased concentration, forgetful, loud noises bother you, feel like you can run out of your body, jump out of your clothes, overwhelmed, sleep disturbances, despondent, and earworms, a part of a song stuck in your head for weeks in a row, just a part of a song. And lots of times my depressed patient will go, who called? That's me. And then from there I go, okay, let's talk. Depression is a protective mechanism. You have genes in your brain to make you depressed. And we'll go back 40,000 years when you were a caveman, and let's say, you know, the weather changed and there was a drought, all the animals moved away. The whole group started getting hungry. They started getting depressed. They started fighting with each other. They thought they were being possessed by evil spirits. So they packed their stuff and moved. And most of the migration across the planet has been due to depression, where things got bad. You got depressed, you packed your stuff, and you ran away. And that this is not, you're not mentally ill because you're not seeing and hearing things that are not there. You've got all the stuff that I just told you about. And once you get out of the, you know, out of the labeling that depressed people are mentally ill. No, they're depression's the number two health problem on the planet, and that is because we're genetically programmed to get depressed when things get bad. And when my patients get those tools, then they go, oh, yeah. And I said, here, I'll give you another one. When the prehistoric people got really depressed, they all went back up in the cave. There was no fire. And they sat in the dark and cried and fought. And I said, how about on a Saturday when the sun's shining and you got nothing to do? Do you sit in a dark room and watch TV? And I had one guy goes, I have tar paper on my windows. And I went, yep. And I said, you are going back to the cave. You're making a nice dark area to hide in. And so you've got to open those windows up and get the light in, because you're actually hiding in the cave again. And once I get
Hello,
that going.
This is a call-in for Doug's show.
Now, this one thing, again, when you're looking at all the dry alcohol and drug abuse and misuse of medications, whether they're over-the-counter or they're prescribed or wherever you get them, illegal drugs, I mean, all this stuff is available out there if you're going to pay the price. And there's obviously, as you've said over and over again, doctors who prescribe this stuff without thinking about the holistic medicine. How do we get the medical professionals to look at the body in the holistic nature? And then how do we get the individuals to deal with their frustrations in some holistic, beneficial way other than, well,
yes,
I need another beer?
Well, that.
Yeah, Doug, this is Denise calling in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a few minutes, just called in. I'm up in D.C. on a trip and be going to Orange, New Jersey for the research studies there. And just wanted to call in quickly, and sorry to interfere, but I just got a few minutes and wanted to call in. We want to recognize Steve, who was our NGWRC executive director. Don't know if it was announced on the show earlier, but Steve died at work at his desk this past week. So we're trying to remember him and not to be depressed about it, but he gave his all for his troops. He was a Ranger, Special Forces, and it's a very sad day that we've lost him. He had heart troubles. He and his brother both served. His brother has MS. So they're both Gulf War vets, and wanted to recognize him today. And just a quick report that we still have our congressional law on the line, our bill, H.R. 4261. Want to encourage everybody to call their two U.S. senators in D.C. Keep pressing them to get that bill through the Senate. And the last thing is Father's Day. I want to wish all the vets that are and fathers a very happy Father's Day. We spent it today at the Father of Our Country's place at Mount Vernon. So I just wanted to jump in just for a minute and know that you're just discussing depression, which a lot of GFOR vets are going through. And, you know, you've got to get up and move, get out of those dark rooms, even if it's go outside, get some sunshine. We all run low vitamin D. Get some sunshine, try to walk a little bit, get out of your house, get some little bit of exercise, no matter how little it is, with all of our illnesses that we're dealing with. So that's kind of why I wanted to call in today. I'm on a trip and spending time with my daughter and husband up in D.C., and we'll be headed to Orange, New Jersey for 3 studies down there this week.
Okay, great. Gary, are
and
you still there?
Please remember Steve. He served his country well and cared about vets. I saw him at the last RAC meeting. I would not have ever believed it would have been the last time I saw him.
Yeah, I mean, this show is dedicated to Steve's memory. I mean, the two of us worked together and talked on all types of different things. And once Steve started getting out to all the documentaries and revealing the problems, he started to really have an impact to change things. And we got an angel is all I can say. You know, God made a choice, and we lost one of our own, but now God's got an angel up there to help us.
That's correct, and thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I only have a few minutes and wanted to call in. I'm usually your co-host, so but off on a trip, and I just noticed the time and wanted to call in and thank you for your guest today.
Yep.
And let us remember all the fathers and those that are Gulf War vets have gone and filling it very much today. And Vietnam Wall has all kinds of flowers up for the fathers that went before. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Gary, are you still there?
I am. I was, you know, I tell a lot of my patients that as physicians, we've forgotten that death is not the enemy. It's pain and suffering. And that, you know, the first time I ran the emergency room at St. Louis City Hospital, they brought in a very elderly man. They were doing cardiac resuscitation on him. And I went, everybody stop. And I looked at him. His pupils were dilated. He had no pulse. I went, the man is dead. And they went, are we going to do any more? And I went, no. This is death. This is it. We're done. And it's interesting because there's a parallel with it. In prehistoric times, when somebody got really sick, the medicine man came and went into the hut, sang the songs all night, and burned sage or whatever, or maybe blistered their skins, and in the morning would come out and go, I'm sorry, I tried everything. They've gone to the big great spirit in the sky. And we do the same thing in hospitals. We have codes now where we run in and we follow a ritualized pattern of doing things to the body to try to bring it back. And it makes us feel good, and most of the time it doesn't work. And it's an exact parallel to what we did in prehistoric times.
You know, one of the things that I did when I first got into emergency medicine is EMT-type thing, combat medicine. You have to sit down and listen and talk to the patient, find everything about them, how they're doing, a good case history, talk to them and find out what's happening. And I think there's so much reliance today on technology that
right.
What I've seen, physicians have forgot to talk to the patient, and people have forgot to talk to the physician. I mean, it's all broken, isn't it?
It is. Electronic health records, you sit down with a patient, and you got a laptop in front of you, and the clock is running, and you got to start checking off boxes. And if you check off the first box, it will then print out, oh, maybe a small paragraph, none of which that you asked, that said, patient's doing fine, he has no complaints, blah, 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 blah. You check off that box. Lungs. Check, and it prints out three lines about examination of lungs, and within a few minutes you've created four pages of typed out information that an insurance company can look at and go, oh, well, look all the time he spent with this guy. And most of the time is spent checking the boxes off, so it'll print out, you know, a visit with the patient. And patient's going, I get a question about something. He goes, wait a minute, I'm not done yet. And they keep working on the laptop. And the electronic health records, it's going to be a disaster because the theory is that you break your leg in Miami, somebody can get online to your doctor's office in Casper and Wyoming and get all your information. This is going to end up with people stealing information, people putting worms into hospitals, and their power systems will burn up. It's going to be a total disaster, and they haven't even – it's supposed to be coming down the line soon, but they haven't even decided on what software everybody should use. So some big practices may have to suddenly turn around and spend – $20,000 or $30,000 in whole new systems and whole new and software, because nobody knows which way to go.
Now, the other thing that bothers me, and I'm going to go back, and I was at the University of Illinois in the department, and when we first got the Apples and the Apple IIe's and Apple Pluses
yep.
in, everybody was staggered. Then we got the IBM. Well, as all this stuff was put on computer disks, 6 months later, the languages and how they ran all disappeared, and now nobody has access to that information. So that simple hard copy you need is sort of like when I was a combat medic, one of the things in EMT, and when we taught the EMT stuff at the University of Illinois, hospital on emergency medical service. We taught, write it down, look and find out, talk to the person, and do and everything. I think the most fascinating thing I did, I was teaching primary and secondary survey for the U of I Med School in Champaign, Illinois, for the third-year students. And they said, well, how do you want us to come dressed? And I just want you guys all to come in swimming suits. Girls, I want you in the two-piece suit. And guys, I want you in just a standard trunk. And they go, what for? I said, we're going to do primary and secondary survey and history, and we're definitely going to learn to do CPR. Well, the kids got there, and they were just staggering and mind-boggling. Wait a minute, what's going on? If you can't see, you can't touch. If you can't touch and you can't talk to them, you ain't going to find a problem. And you got all the technology, ain't going to do any good because that's not what the patient needs. The patient needs a holistic approach. I mean, is there something happening in the medical schools that forgot that's the best way to do it since antiquity?
Yeah, what is happening is that they're being really forced by the government and the insurance companies to go to a completely computerized network. And fortunately for me, I'm a very, very active 66 years old. I'm too old to be, because I'm supposedly close to retirement age, I don't have to do electronic health records. So I'm still writing them by hand, and I'm very, very happy with doing that. The then suddenly, like you were saying, Windows 8 came out, and holy crap, a lot of doctors' offices, you know, suddenly brought Windows, they bought new laptops and brought in Windows 8, and it wouldn't run with the software they had. You know, I mean, you can still buy new laptops today with Windows 7 in it because 8 was like Windows Vista and Windows Me put together. I mean, it's a nightmare.
The whole thing seems to be broken. I mean, to come back to this whole thing, the alcohol and drug abuse that we're seeing across everything, it's not only in the soldiers, it's in the children, it's in the families, it's in the spouses. It's just all over the place and has been coming out recently. I mean, the deliberate and willful neglect as far as proper medical care and his histories and listening and seeing. I think one of the most frustrating things I know for myself and others, and we've had this on the show ad nauseum, is the doctor didn't listen to me. He wants to disavow any connection between the toxic exposure and the health effect to avoid liability. And so now the kid is sit there left hanging in the air. He's in tremendous pain. He can't get proper medical care. So now we see incredible levels of child and spouse abuse. Then we see personal abuse. And at some point, I mean, God almighty, I mean, Gary, how do we turn it around?
Well, we have to cut down the frequency and use of opiates, and where people just right off the bat go, write your prescription for Percocet, and here they go. I write no class 2 drugs unless it's a terminal situation. And now what I'm doing is that my patients that are over the age of 50, who have 45 to 50, who have been on chronic narcotics for 20 years for, you know, three different back surgeries that didn't work, I go, I got a good idea. Why don't we get rid of these pain pills that aren't working anymore? And here's a sheet of paper and to sign up for the state of Nevada for a medical marijuana card. And you're allowed to grow 12 plants. And if you check around, there are certain plants that are low in THC, the drug that makes you high, and high in other chemicals that actually work for pain relief, and get out of the narco and stuff, and start growing marijuana and give it a try. And our stores are going to be coming out soon in Nevada, selling you know, packaged marijuana for medical use only. And I stay at 45 and older just so I'm, you know, trying to get out of my abuse people. And I really check the people, too, when they, you know, if I'm going to give them a medical marijuana card. We can run them on a Nevada, on a computer system with the Nevada Pharmacy Board and see how many narcotics they're going through per month and how many doctors they're going through per month. And sometimes I'll walk in and hand them a sheet of paper and go, you've committed 5 felonies. Look at, you had 5 different doctors here for narcotics and in the last month, and you didn't tell any of these doctors that you got narcotics from anybody else. So we've got 2 options. One, you're going to go into an outpatient program, and we're going to start detoxing you. Or two, I'll just call the local police, they'll come over and take you over and put you in a cell. And you'll end up with probation for 5 years. And it really helps to just spend that extra few minutes and drug profile your patient and see. And then my patients that take pain medicines, we have a pain contract with them that they sign. And they understand that when they come in for their pain medicine, at any time, we can get a drug screen on them. And so they realize that. So, you know, sometimes they'll come in, and once in a while, we go, it's drug screen time today. You haven't had one in a long, long time. Let's do it. And bingo, there's no narcotics in them because they're selling them on the street. I've had 74-year-old women selling their pain pills. And or sometimes we'll screen them, and no pain pills, but wow, methamphetamine. They're selling the pain pills off for meth, and we go, okay, we got some major problems with you now. Here's your options. What do you want to do? And you know, most of the time we can get them into at least an outpatient program and start detoxing them and get them on their antidepressants because they're depressed people anyway. Because a paper came out 6 months ago from the University of St. Louis and said that 80% of people who chronically take opioid drugs, pain pills, develop depression. And, you know, and it's the same thing with alcohol. And the veterans come home and they're depressed and they're on drugs and they're drinking. And the next thing you know, they're fighting with the wife and the kids, and the divorce happens, and out they go on the street, and then sometimes you get a suicide because there's nobody in there to help them when they get to that point.
Now, isn't there all, I mean, one thing that I've learned, there's all kinds of adjunctive medical techniques for pain management. What I found works real well, get a TENS unit.
Yeah.
You've got myofascia release, you've got ultrasound, you've got thermal wraps and all this stuff.
Physical therapy.
It has to be balanced together by a doctor that's going to use it and continue it.
Yeah, but they just, you know, and you have physical therapy too. And I tell my patients, you know, they go, I say, I'm sending you physical therapy. And they go, well, I don't think I need it. And I went, I'll tell you what, half of physical therapy is getting out of the house and getting into the car and driving to the physical therapist, okay? Because if not, you're going to just sit in the house. And I said, we're going to get you physical therapy. And, geez, you know, I wish insurance would pay for massage therapy. And, you know, so that they could get their backs and necks massaged and start working in opposite ways instead of just throwing narcotics at everybody. It's just, it's worthless. And there, you know, there are pain pill doctors that you walk in, sit down, and they go, what do you want? And the guy goes, Percocet, about 180. Okay, 180 Percocet. That'll be $100, please. Thank you very much. Next patient. And they actually do it that way. I mean, we've actually, in Las Vegas, they've had doctors that had, it was like drive-thrus. You drive through and get your prescription and pay and drive away and go get your narcotics. I mean, it's just out of control.
Yeah, I mean, when did you decide to, I mean, you've been champion as a holistic medicine, this whole thing. When did you decide to champion? Has this been something you've done through all your medical career, or did you have one of those brilliant moments where it all came together with a realization?
It was more of a realization. It was you know, it was over time, and probably 30 years ago, I was just getting out here in Fallon. And my kids were little and lots of stress, and wasn't sleeping well. And I came home one day, and I said to myself, if I don't feel better soon, I think I'll just shoot myself. And I went, interesting thought. let's walk this through. And so I picked up a pistol and looked at it and went, I can see how people can do this. Put the gun away and went and talked to a psychiatrist, and he went, oh, you're depressed. Here, take these pills. And I walked out and I went, you know, what if I would come in and to a surgeon and go, you've got a large tumor in your chest? And I would say, why? And he goes, well, you smoke a pack and a half a day for 30 years. You've got a cancer in there. Okay, now I can deal with this because I know what it is. The problem still today is the psychiatrist, the psychologist goes, oh, you've got bipolar, or you've got depression. Here, take these pills. And you don't get many tools. So what I did over the 30 years is start to develop explaining and finding a way. And I talked for 10 years before they found the genes that cause depression. And then for another 15 years, I've been talking about my caveman model. And just last year in Scientific American, they came out and said, psychiatrists are beginning to think that depression may be due to negative external events happening to the human, resulting in the chemicals going down in their brain. And I thought, good Lord, they're finally catching up here. And so because of my work with depression, then I got into drug and alcohol therapy, and I'm now medical director of 4 inpatient drug and alcohol facilities, and then one huge county called Lyon County, I'm the director of all the outpatient facilities. And we try to keep everybody together and keep everybody on the same page and, you know, and take care of our people. And I saw a gentleman last week, and he walked in and goes, I fell off the wagon. I went back on meth. And I went, oh, so you peed dirty, you know, with your probation officer? And he goes, no. I knew I was dirty. I went in and turned myself into the probation officer. And I went, good. That means you left here with some tools. Now you're going to come back. We're going to give you some more tools. And maybe you'll come back one more time, and then maybe we won't see you again. But, you know, congratulations. Gave him a hug and went, sit down and let's get working. And you have to do that. And it's tough because the funding for the drug war is just not there. I mean, they put a fence across between us and Mexico, and you got kids streaming through the into the country. We can't stop the influx of medicines from other worlds. I mean, from other countries. We used to have meth labs in Nevada, and every once in a while they'd blow one up and, you know, and burn a house down. We don't have them anymore. We outsourced our meth production to Mexico. You know, nobody around here makes it anymore. It all comes in from Mexico. And you can't compete with the price.
All these problems have seemed overwhelming because the guy is frustrated. He wants a drug, so the doctor's pushing drugs for PTSD. And this is something we can talk again, I know, because you've written about it and talked about it before. Is the realization that all these dang wars have been getting in are just, you know, money-making stuff for greed and power, and all the vets going back to Vietnam War and maybe even before that, but since the Vietnam War, all this stuff has been over greed and power, and the vet is looking out there trying to find some justification for what he did, the actions he took, and some pill or drug is not going to alleviate that ethical and moral crisis because it's not a physiological effect. But as you said, the doctors pushes the drugs to resolve the problem as if, well, I'll somehow dumb his brain down, though he doesn't think about it. So if he doesn't think about it, then somehow it's going to cure it. I mean, it's busted.
I see that. I get patients that are first time come in, and they've come from a psychiatric facility in Reno or somewhere. And I talk to them, and I go, how you doing? They go, fine. What are you taking for medication? And they dump this bag full of drugs out, and I went, oh, okay, they just medicated the, you know, crap out of you, so you were nice and quiet in their facility, and they could collect the insurance and then threw you out. And so we're going to start throwing this stuff in the wastebasket. And the problem is that they don't take the time to, you know, be able to counsel people and give them some tools and have them come back for outpatient therapy and follow up and stuff. And you know, our drug problem would be a lot lower if we had, you know, more businesses and the military doing drug screening. We had a casino here in town and 10 years ago, and I started drug screening everyone that got in an accident, you know, or hurt themselves, which was an industrial accident. We drug screened them. And then everybody that came in, new employees, we drug screened them. And after a year, I called up the owner of the casino and I went, what are you doing? I haven't seen anybody with an industrial injury from your facility for a long time. He said the year before we did drug screening, we had $11,000 with industrial insurance. He goes, this year it's $150, and my theft rate has gone down, and my employees fighting with customers has disappeared too, because everybody in here is clean now. And he says it's just wondrous. And Utah, the state of Utah one time had a paper out that for every buck you spent in drug screening, you saved $1,100 in broken equipment, stolen equipment, people not showing up for work, people getting in fights at work, people coming to work and shooting people. You know, just fantastic results.
Gary, we're about out of time here.
Yep.
You know, first thing, I want to thank Patricia Axelrod, director of Desert Storm Think Tank, for setting this up. I mean, this has been incredible. Gary, I mean, you're talking about ways to solve the problems. Can you please come back and continue this conversation based on your schedule on our show?
I certainly will, because I'm beginning to work on, I have a book called Pandemic that is, you can get it at survivalcenter.com. And that book's been out for a little while, but I'm headed into starting to do my book on depression. And so that people can buy the book.
Well, Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think our time is out, ladies and gentlemen.